Hello and welcome to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast, where every week your favorite three amigos break down the weekly box office movie news, new released movies, and of course, in our second segment, which is everyone's favorite, we break down our own personal thoughts, opinions, and feelings about a franchise, about our favorite movies that fall into that category. Overall, you're just going to have a fun movie-going listening experience. With me, as always, of course, is the one and only Benny Hamlin and the illustrious JTE. Gentlemen, we're talking Insidious this week. It's going to get a little scary. I know for me, I'm a 6'5", 235-pound wuss when it comes to horror movies. I may have been the only one who actually like yelled out in the theater during my viewing of the Insidious movie. So this is going to be an interesting review for us. But how are you guys doing today? Good to have you.
I'm amazing, but I mean, that's my baseline. I'm constantly amazing. So this isn't like an above and beyond amazing. I'm an everyday amazing today.
Wow. I mean, that's hard to live up to, but I'm doing pretty great. I'm about to go on vacation. We're about to record this podcast. Our next podcast might be a little bit later due to scheduling, but we are not going to miss Mission Impossible because maybe the best action franchise going on right now. John Wick's kind of, you know, behind it, but this is what, 7 movies deep?
Yeah,
it's so impressive. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about this movie and just talk about James Wan, and kind of like he's kind of like the Stephen King of our time in some ways. He's not writing all these movies, but when it comes to just horror, maybe Wes Craven isn't a better analogy. So I'm really looking forward to our second segment and just kind of dive into what he's accomplished, because it's pretty impressive.
Well, speaking of James Wan and the Insidious franchise, let's kick off with the box office breakdown as we normally do. Insidious came out this weekend firing on all cylinders. On a $16 million budget, this movie has already made $31 million, taking the number one spot. Dropping by 53% to the second spot is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny with $28 million. Remember, that is a $295 million budget that is going into Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So you have to assume this movie is going to lose Disney a lot of money. Number three, Sound of Freedom, which is Angel Pictures, kind of right-wing funded movie, came out this weekend starring Jim Caviezel. That actually made $15 million this weekend to take the third spot. I'm going to pronounce this correct because our good friend Mike Deakin keeps pointing out that I don't. Elemental came in fourth place with $9 million in its fourth week. Number five, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, $7.7 million. That's week six. It's now the second highest grossing movie behind Guardians of the Galaxy this year. I'm sure Mission Impossible has its own thoughts and feelings about that. Number six, new release Joyride, making $6 million. Not, I think, what we were... what the studio was hoping for out of this comedy. I personally saw this comedy, and we'll have our good friend Jeffrey, the one-eyed King Kong, on in a little bit to discuss his feelings on that. But Joyride making $6 million. Number seven, another raunchy comedy with no hard feelings, making $5 million. Number eight, Transformers Rise of the Beasts at $4.7 million. The Little Mermaid still chugging along in the top 10 with $3.3 million in its seventh week. And finally, wrapping out the top 10, Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, goes from sixth place to now 10th place in the box office with $2.8 million. I threw a lot out there, a lot of numbers. I'm going to lead off with you, JT. What is the tale of the box office?
It just goes to show you, horror genre is one of the most bankable genres in the box office. Megan was a huge hit earlier this year. Also Blumhouse, small budget. I don't know. For me, it's like Blumhouse just kind of, he doesn't go by movie stars, because I think a lot of people talk these days how the age of the movie stars, which brings everybody to the box office, it's kind of dead. In some ways, I agree. I feel like we're in the age of the IP and the concept. If you just have a great concept and you can cut together a really good trailer, especially in the horror genre, I feel like people are going to come out. They just want that scare. They just want that. Megan had this whole like social media explosion before it came out, which is basically free press. And Insidious, again, it is a sequel. I think it does help that Patrick Wilson also stars in the Conjuring films, because I think some people just think these are like Conjuring movies. They don't exactly. I mean, both the first Insidious was directed by James Wan, and so is the first two films in this series. This one's actually directed by Patrick Wilson. And I just think, you know, having those familiar faces, having that familiar scares that you know you're going to get with a James Wan type horror film is just comforting for people, and they know they're going to get their money's worth when they go out to go see a movie that weekend. So I'm not surprised that it made this much money, but I am a little surprised it made double its budget in one weekend. I mean, listen, the horror genre, I'm about to start writing a horror script after this, because I feel like if I get something produced, I'm going to make some money.
I think it is. I think the initial pitch for our horror movie is going to be there's a like demon behind Benny in his basement right now. But since this is an audio only podcast, just JTE and I can witness this whole thing. I think that's the start of our of our $1 million script right there.
Kind
of
like Host. I got it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Benny, what does the box office tell you?
Well, I know that the last couple of weeks have been talking quite a bit about like these movies like, you know, Fast X and Indiana Jones and The Flash with these massive budgets. And this just goes to point out that if you make a movie responsibly, you can still make an enjoyable movie that's meant for theaters that can make money. Like when you look at it, Indiana Jones, its opening weekend made double what The Conjuring did this week. The Conjuring is viewed as a massive success. And if you Google Indiana Jones right now, like the first 10 articles you're going to see is Indiana Jones, flop of the box office. And that's strictly because it has made so much money. And I think there are a lot of reasons that go into it. It's like Disney, especially, I think, and also DC, the comic book movies in general, spend so much money on like unneeded computer effects. It inflates the budgets of these movies, and it's unneeded. And it's hard for them to make their money back. And so eventually studios are just going to stop making them. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we'll get something different. You know, time always turns and what's popular changes. And we may be moving past that era to an era of smaller movies like the John Wicks and the Insidious, and we'll see how it shakes out. But I would say that Indiana Jones, it had a lot better legs than I thought of. Like the its drop was a lot less than I expected, but its opening weekend where it started from, even though it held pretty well, it's still going to be rough for it to make its money back in the theatrical window. But I mean, I'm sure 25 years from now, they're going to sell a Blu-ray copy to someone stupid enough to still be buying physical media pointing at JTE, and they'll make like $3 on this movie, but it's going to be 20 years from now, you know? And I know
I have Indiana Jones of physical media. I will find the most rare Blu-rays and put them in my own museum. Physical media until I die.
And so those are the two things that jumped out on me. I am not surprised that Joyride did not, you know, did what it did. Like outside of like the little movie Twitter sphere, like in everyday life, I've seen nothing about the movie. I've not seen previews for it. I've not heard anyone mention it in any way. So I'm not surprised it didn't do well, but we'll have to see if it legs out, because everyone that's seen it, you know, in this little sphere has just said it's amazing. So we'll have to see how time holds. But those are my initial thoughts on the box office this week.
You guys both touched on it, and I'll say it for a third time. Blumhouse Productions, they know how to be able to invest in a movie. I mean, this movie, the budget was $16 million. That includes marketing total. This movie came out and made $31 million. All these Blumhouse movies always turn an immediate profit because they don't invest a ton of money. And they're mostly horror-centric movies that come out of Blumhouse, but they know how to do the jump scares. They know how to put in the right amount of money. And they know that, like, these horror movies, they make a lot of money in the first couple of weeks. And so I think it's like Moneyball, right? If you've ever watched a movie Moneyball, every team after the Oakland A's first initial attempt to be able to like basically buy their their World Series or their playoffs, every team went with that model afterwards. In fact, the Boston Red Sox snapped that losing streak by using the bunny ball technique. And I think studios might start taking some notes from the Blumhouse model and stop investing $300-400 million into these giant tentpole movies and maybe scale them down a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I would think that if I were a studio, and especially somewhere like Warner Brothers, where I've just lost hundreds of millions of dollars on what should have been a huge tentpole movie this year in like The Flash, and go, okay, maybe the next Superman movie needs to be scaled down and we give that a $50 million budget. It's an interesting box office this weekend. I, like you, Benny, was surprised Indiana Jones did as well as it did this weekend. It only dropped 53% and it still made $28 million. There's no way this movie, even on an international level, is going to make back its budget, but it did still have legs and people went out and saw it. A surprising one to me is The Sound of Freedom. Movie, the Jim Caviezel led like espionage spy movie. We see this from time to time, this like Angel Pictures or these like Christian marketed funded movies will come in and they make a splash usually their first week, and then they're out of the top 10 box office usually by like week two or week three. So it's interesting to see that one do as well as it did, and I feel like the people who are going to pay to watch that movie have already come out and seen it. This movie I don't think is going to have a ton of legs. And then, of course, we have to talk about Ruby Gilman, Teenage Crack. And we talked about it last week, and I'm just going to say it again. I mean, this movie's going to be streaming next week, right? I mean,
yeah. It's like, do we have really to talk about it? Because nobody else is. It just kind of came and went like, you know, a bad fart, man.
I think society as a whole has agreed we don't have to talk about it at this point
anymore. I mean, here's the thing. DreamWorks really did make a name for themselves in animation, especially in like the early 2000s, the mid-2000s. They had a lot of huge hits, and it is a little sad to see DreamWorks Animation put something out like this and just completely flop. But you know what? I think they're already working on Kung Fu Panda 4, and that'll be a huge hit, and they'll be right back where they need to be.
They're like, rush that movie out, please. It's the only way we're going to be able to recover financially from Ruby Gilman.
What a horrible name for it. I mean, just a bad title for a movie.
Everything about this movie, and I haven't seen it, so I'm like, my judgment is just purely from the outside, but everything I've seen about this movie just screams like, why did this get greenlit? Like, the name is terrible. The animation looks sloppy and terrible.
What's the name again?
Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken.
Yeah, see, if it should be like Ruby Gilman, lawyer for the stars or something. Yeah. Sounds like a lawyer's name I would hear in Hollywood. It's a complete write-off. You can just, like I said last week, the studio, I think, had zero faith. And this is tough because usually animated films like Elemental has shown it can have legs in the summer. And I'm actually curious to see Barbie, how it does, because I don't know if it's really geared for kids. It doesn't seem like it is. It seems like more like a meta, kind of like for an older audience. It feels like Greta Gerwig made a movie for herself and not so much for kids. So I'm really curious to see how that plays.
I think Barbie's going to do gangbusters, though. Just the name alone, I think, is going to sell a lot of.
Yeah, it'll make money. Just maybe not like, you know, Elemental money. I don't know if it'll make as much as Elemental. So Elemental's going to be. Do you think Barbie could hit 200 million?
Yeah, I think it's going to hit 200 million in 2 weeks.
If it's good.
No, it'll hit 200 million regardless.
Okay. In domestic, I'm talking.
Domestic?
Maybe global.
First week, 70 million. Second week, 35. So it'll make about 110 in its first 2 weeks, if I were guessing.
Interesting. So you think it'll make more than Indiana Jones?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Right. I'm with Benny on that.
I think it will make more than Indiana Jones. I just don't know if it'll hit 200 million. We'll see. I could be completely wrong.
Well, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago with the rumor of Ben Affleck returning as Daredevil in Deadpool 3. Now it is confirmed that Jennifer Garner is actually going to be reprising her role 20 years later as Elektra Natchios in the Deadpool 3 movie. So I feel like we have to reopen this conversation of possibility. We have Elektra, right? Daredevil's girlfriend. do we get Daredevil? What are your guys' thoughts of this new addition to Deadpool 3? It sounds to me like Deadpool's just going to be sliding through all the different kind of Marvel universes. So it makes me curious now. I mean, do we get Wesley Snipes' Blade? Like, do we want to just go balls to the wall and see how many, like, do we get Chris Evans returning as like Johnny Storm and, you know, Michael Chiklis as the Thing? Like, how deep into this is it going to go? We're bringing back Jennifer Garner as Electra Nachos. But Benny, I'm going to start off with you, man.
So every time they announce a new cameo in this movie, the more like sense of dread that I get, I feel like I'm just going to be watching like cameos loosely held together with sort of a story. And I enjoy the first two Deadpools, but like other people, I am not obsessed with them. They're, to me, they're not top tier comic book movies for me, even though I enjoy them. And so I dread it. And, you know, we all have actors that just do not work for us. And like, for me, like Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Garner are the actor and actress for me that they just don't work. No matter what you put them in, it's just a no for me. And so whenever you put Jennifer Garner in anything, for me, it's a no. And that's completely a personal thing. I don't even know why it is that way, but it is that way. And I will say that I think she was one of the most miscast superheroes in the history of superheroes being cast. The Elektra movie did not work on any level. And if you watch the director's cut of Daredevil, which is a much better movie, it makes it an okay, pretty solid 90s, you know, style comic book movie. A lot of what they did was cut out scenes with Jennifer Garner. And to me, she just doesn't work as that character. And maybe it's 20 years later, maybe she's got a new thing, and maybe the Deadpool writers are obviously better than the Elektra writers and they'll have something creative for her. But yeah, to me, this is a hard pass.
Yeah, you know, I just wish these things weren't coming out and being leaked out to the press, because I feel like she is one of probably many cameos that will be in this film. I'm sure there's some cameos they will make sure that never make it into the public eye as much as they can. But yeah, Daredevil as Ben Affleck rumor, this in a way just kind of confirms it. I mean, listen, their ex-husband, ex-wife, they probably talked about it before they agreed to do it together. He's like, yeah, let's go back. This will be fun. I agree. I don't think she was a great Elektra, but she wasn't bad. And it's funny because Benny said it's like an okay 90s movie. It came out in the 2000s. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
It feels like a bad 90s movie. Yeah, so I'm excited for the doors this could open, because I feel like this is going to be a cameo fest. And that since Loaded Weapon from the early 90s, will there be more cameos in a single like comedy? So I'm pretty excited for that aspect. And this does open the door for my 1980s Howard the Duck cameo. I want the 80s version of Howard the Duck. I don't want Seth Green as a CGI duck. Is the actor who played the voice of Howard the Duck still around? I don't know. I hope he is, because I want him to come back. I want the whole CGI prosthetic suit. I want everything. I want that Howard Duck. And I want Ryan Reynolds to make a off comment about duck boobs, because it's going to happen.
Well, this third Deadpool is directed by Shawn Levy. And the collaborations that Ryan Reynolds and Shawn Levy have had over the last couple of years, I loved Free Guy. I thought Free Guy was so much fun. And then the Adam Project was the one that they did with Netflix. And I really loved the Adam Project.
Well, I didn't like either of those movies.
Oh, no shit.
So it shows you what side I'm on. And I'll be honest, I'm not a huge Ryan Reynolds fan, but I do like him in Deadpool. I think he's perfect for that character.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was not a fan of either of those films directed by Shawn Levy. Free Guy, I was pretty down on. And I thought, what was the second one called? The Netflix one?
The Adam Project.
I liked it a little bit better than Free Guy, but still, it was like, I'll watch this once and I'll probably never, ever watch it again. That's just me.
I mean, Ryan Reynolds is tailor-made to be Deadpool. Like, that is perfect casting right there. And I know that these Deadpool movies, like, the whole Deadpool series for Ryan Reynolds are passion projects. He put together that fan film, put it out there, leaked it. It got so much traction that the studio was like, okay, we'll give you $60 million to make the first Deadpool movie. And that movie made gangbusters. And I'm much of a fan of the Deadpool movies, both one and two. And it's one of those series where like I could watch them both back to back and go, you know what? I like two more. Or then watch it again and go, okay, I like Deadpool one. Because you really do see Reynolds' love into these movies. So I do trust, and it this is, remember too, this is going to be Wade Wilson's entrance into the MCU. So you've also got, you know, the big looming eye of Kevin Feige, which I think after the last several disappointing movies, aside from Guardians of the Galaxy, Feige's probably got all of his attention on the upcoming movies in the MCU slate. So I trust that Deadpool 3 is going to handle these. Am I excited about, or I trust that Deadpool 3 will handle these types of cameos with the proper grace that they were due. Am I excited about Jennifer Garner returning as Elektra? I like Benny thought that was seriously a big misfire with her. I think she was hot off of that TV show Alias, and they were like, okay, we just got to put her in as many things as they can. The Elektra movie is a huge swing and a miss. That movie is really boring.
Like, it's not even a swing, man. They left the bat in the dugout and just came out there and got hit in the nuts with the ball.
You know what? I will say this, Moose. Like, when I hear the casting of Jennifer Garner coming back as Elektra, I'm not so much like excited to see her back as I am excited to see Deadpool kind of tear her down.
Yes.
And what I'm more just excited to see how Deadpool's going to interact with these people. So much more than I am excited to see them back as those characters. I'm like, oh, this is just cannon fodder for Deadpool to just go on a rant and just basically roast every Marvel movie. Like, I'm hoping for like a Chris Evans Fantastic Four cameo, bring in Jessica Alba. Like, I want to see it all. I just want to see him roast them all.
I think that's what's going to end up happening. I think these are going to be very like tongue in cheek type cameos where these stars, Jennifer Garner knows Elektra was not a good movie. And so I agree with you. I think that that's exactly how these are going to be handled. And I'm also with you, JT. Like, I don't like knowing that a lot of these casts are coming back. I don't like these rumors. Oh, that this person's going to be cast. Oh, it's confirmed. So I'm with you. Like, I believe now that Ben Affleck will return as Daredevil, that Deadpool will slide into that universe with Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner as Daredevil and Elektra, and then he'll slide out of it. I don't have like any false illusions that they're going to be assembling a team of these like old Marvel. I think they're going to show up. It's going to be a little tongue-in-cheek cameo. Like, Jennifer Garner's not going to play like an essential role in this. She reprised her role for probably a 3-minute scene, and that's going to be it. And then they're going to move on to the next universe. So overall, I think Deadpool 3 is just going to be a lot of fun. Our next story, and we're basically going to be talking about the writer Akiva Goldsman, who is now confirming that he's been given the green light to start writing the script for I Am Legend 2, a sequel to the 2007 movie directed by Francis Lawrence. And Francis Lawrence also hired him to start writing the sequel script to the 2005 movie Constantine, starring Keanu Reeves. Both movies directed by Francis Lawrence, both movies originally written by Akiva Goldsman. Benny, you pointed out when we were talking pre-show that, wait, aren't we in a writer's strike? How is Akiva Goldsman being given the green light to do these things?
I don't know. Apparently he's a scab, man.
Yeah, he must have crossed the lines, apparently. But this is interesting. I mean, these are two, you know, Constantine came out in 2005. I Am Legend came out in 2007. So you're talking movies that are well over, by the time these are released, well over 20 years later, sequels to these originals. And I believe that both are still planning on having the original actors. So somehow Will Smith will be in the sequel to this movie, and somehow, well, I shouldn't say somehow, but Keanu Reeves is expected to reprise his role as Constantine. So what's your guys' thoughts on the sequels to these early 2000 movies being coming out sometime probably in the next 2 or 3 years?
I'm really interested in the Constantine sequel. Like, the original Constantine is like a guilty pleasure superhero movie. I love that movie, man. I watch it every few years, and I there are problems with it, but they had an amazing cast. Like, I thought Keanu Reeves was a solid Constantine. I don't care what people say. And the devil and Gabriel, I thought they're both cast great. Like, there's just so much about that movie I enjoyed, man. So I would be super excited to revisit that world. I assume it's going to be an else world and not part of James Gunn's new DC. If it is part of the new DC, all the more better, man. I am thrilled about that. I Am Legend I don't know why they're making this movie at all on any level. Like Will Smith, you know, after his Oscar, you know, faux pas, even before that, was in steep decline as a box office draw. And this is not like an IP that's going to have people pouring out the doors. And it's probably a movie that you're going to have to put a lot of money in. Like the first movie, even for the time that it came out, was very CGI heavy. So to me, this just sounds like bad ideal written all over it. And I don't know, you know, it's not a world. I was like, man, if I wish this I Am Legend story kept going. So maybe there are people out there and there's a passionate fan base I don't know about. But I don't understand why that movie's being made, in all honesty.
You know, I need to revisit Constantine because I remember seeing it in theaters, but that's kind of where my memory ends. I don't remember much about the movie. I remember it being fine when I saw it, but there's nothing ever that drew me back to watch it. Honestly, the fact that they might be making sequels, the only thing that's like, oh, maybe I need to revisit that movie, because there is a big fan base out there for it. I mean, it has a cult following. I just remember not loving it when I saw it, but again, that was a long time ago. My taste has changed. I might have underappreciated it. So I'm always up for going back and watching movies. I think it would be a fun film for Keanu to come back as an older John Wick-esque Constantine. And I do love the supernatural, you know, heaven and hell kind of aspect. I love those. I love when they do that in a film. So that kind of grabs me all right away. And I agree. I don't think it would be part of the new DC universe, but it could be. I mean, that'd be a cool way to have Keanu Reeves kind of lead, be this elder, you know, wizard or whatever the hell he is in the DCU. I think that could be pretty cool. Well, I am excited, though, for I Am Legend because I actually really like that first film. Listen, he dies at the end. Spoiler. I don't know how they're going to. Some people said they're going to use the ending, the alternate ending that was on the Blu-ray. But I just don't think you could do that. You have to go with what the original ending was. They're just going to have to explain how he survived. It's going to cut to him escaping somehow. It'll be a de-aged Will Smith going, like, jumping behind the refrigerator right when the explosion happens. And Michael B. Jordan. Yeah, like Indiana Jones. Michael B. Jordan's, I guess, is going to be in this with him. That was when it was announced. It was Michael B. Jordan and Will Smith. And I think that's a pretty cool team up, something I'd like to see. Listen, zombie movies were all the rave, like, not too long ago. I feel like a really good zombie movie is always going to make some good money. They're not exactly zombies. They're some sort of mutants. They don't really get to what exactly they are. They're some sort of mutated humans. But I really do love that first I Am Legend film. I think it's really well shot. I think the scenes in New York where it's just like, you know, post-apocalyptic and everybody's gone, it's amazing. It's amazing looking. And it actually has a lot of really good heart. I mean, there's a dog scene in that movie that makes you cry every time I watch it. It's heartbreaking. And the action's good. I like Francis Lawrence as a director for the most part. So I'm more excited for that movie. But who knows? Constantine could be the better of the two when it all is said and done.
You see, there it is. Apparently, there is a huge fan base for I Am Legend out there that I was completely unaware of.
See, I'm actually with Benny on this one. I'm leaning more towards the excitement of Constantine than I am of I Am Legend. I Am Legend came out at the perfect time. The Walking Dead was extremely popular. Zombie movies, to your point, JT, were extremely popular. And yeah, maybe these were mutants, but it was still very zombie-esque. And yeah, I'm with you too. I don't know how they're going to unless they start the movie with the alternate ending from the first I Am Legend and then just continue and carry the story from that point on. Because if they are going to bring back Will Smith and I Am Legend 2, which I'm sure they're going to, Will needs a win at this point in time. And this could potentially be it. But the inclusion of Michael B. Jordan does actually excite me a little bit more about the I Am Legend story. I didn't know that when I wrote the story down for us to talk about. So that actually does make me, because I'm a huge Michael B. Jordan fan. The guy is making the right career moves with the roles that he's taking. And so if he believes in this, then and is going to be part of it, then I am a little bit more excited for I Am Legend 2. But Constantine, I love the character of John Constantine. I'm with Benny. I very much enjoy the 2005 movie. I like that there is in the DC world, and Marvel has its own counterpart. We saw that in Werewolf by Night. We were introduced to Elsa Bloodstone, which, like, in the Marvel universe is kind of that, like, you know, you have the Avengers, but then there's like the paranormal side of things, and Doctor Strange and Elsa Bloodstone kind of fall into that. And for the DC universe, it's John Constantine. Superman handles supervillains, but there's the devil and there's demons and there's this whole like occult world. And John Constantine is that man who kind of holds that world at bay in the DC universe. And so I if it is just a spiritual sequel and it has nothing to do with the actual DC universe, fine. But I, like you guys have kind of touched on it, I would like to see that. I'd like to see Constantine be part of that. In the last few years, the character of Constantine has gained a lot of traction in like comic book media, and DC Animation put forth a bunch of Constantine content. He was part of like the Justice League. They were calling it like the Justice League Dark. And he had joined, you know, officially as the Justice League. And it was just interesting to have this kind of supernatural presence in the midst of all of these godlike characters, Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman. And, you know, when you look at Constantine next to like a guy like Batman, Batman's just in this tactical outfit. Constantine wears a trench coat and a tie. Like, it's so different. But I dig it. And I dig the character of Constantine. And I like what DC's been doing. So I'm very excited to hear that this is going to be happening. And yeah, I would love Keanu Reeves. I know in the comic books and in the cartoon formats that Constantine is a British dude. I like Keanu Reeves as Constantine. To your point, JT, I would love to see John Wick basically fighting demons. So I mean, give me all the Keanu Reeves Constantine content I can get.
Is Constantine kind of like an emo Doctor Strange with a trench coat and a cigarette? Like, he's kind of like Doctor Strange, but just the most emo kind of style, I feel.
Essentially.
Like.
Essentially.
Yeah.
That's a fair assessment.
Okay, make sure.
But I would say that just on an offshoot, you know, they just announced that this Swamp Thing movie with James Mangold, you know, is coming out. And Constantine and Swamp Thing are kind of the driving forces of the Justice League Dark. That would be a pretty good, you know, footing to kick things off. Just saying, DC.
DC, if you're listening, have a Constantine Keanu Reeves cameo in there. Well, folks, we are going to take a break. We're going to hear from our commercial sponsors. In our next segment, we are going to talk all things James Wan universe related. Stick around.
It's Red Lobster's new lunch special. Shrimp and chicken, just $3.99. Golden fried shrimp and grilled chicken breast with salad and baked potato, just $3.99 for a limited time at Red Lobster for lunch.
Kiss me.
On October 3rd.
Killing's not his ulterior motive. I bet these women are alive. This guy's a collector.
Morgan Freeman.
When it goes down, I need this guy intact.
Ashley Judd.
I'm the only person who's seen this guy. Take me with you.
From the best-selling novel.
Come on!
Hold it!
Kiss the Girls. Rated R. Everywhere. Friday, October 3rd.
Welcome back, folks. And with us today, we have a special guest. He's going to be joining us for the James Wan segment, and he's going to give us his take on Joyride in our next spoiler segment. However, we are joined by our very good friend, the one and only Jeffrey the King Khan.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for coming on.
What an electric opening. Oh, my God.
High energy.
Calm down, everybody.
It's riveting radio, everyone. Riveting radio. Well, we can't.
I told you to go with the one eye intro.
We can't.
It's early. I'll save it.
Yeah. Well, we'll kick off the Joyride with the one eye then. But we can't discuss the Insidious filmography without discussing the new horror icon, the new cinematic horror icon of this generation. And that would be the one and only James Wan. James Wan has given us such horror movies as Saw, Dead Silence, the original Insidious, the Conjuring franchise, Insidious Aquaman, weirdly enough, if you consider that a horror, I thought it was horrible, so we'll consider it a horrible movie. He's given us Malignant, and he'll be giving us the next entry in the horror franchise, which is Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. But all of these movies, all of these universes, these Insidious, these Conjuring franchises, his hands are still steering the wheels. They may be directed by different entries, but he's producing every one of these. So these are all his IPs. So we can't deny the influence that James Wan has. And we talked about it in our previous segment, his involvement with Blumhouse Films and the success, especially the commercial and monetized success that the James Wan horrorverse has spawned. So I mentioned this previously. I am not the biggest horror fan. I'm quite a sissy when it comes to the horror movies. So of these movies, I've really only seen one or two. So I'm definitely going to rely on you guys to carry this segment. So I'm going to pass it around a little bit. We're going to obviously start with our guest. Now, Jeffrey, your thoughts on James Wan? Is there a favorite in there? If you say Aquaman, we might just drop you from the street.
I mean, I haven't seen a ton of James Wan, but I feel like every time I do watch one of his movies, there's always like an energy to them. Like you can tell he cares about anything he makes or even produces. I think in terms of the horror films he's made, I've only seen the first Conjuring and Malignant. I haven't even gone back and seen Saw. That's how removed I am. But yeah, I just think he has a lot of energy. He tries different things, especially Malignant, where it just goes for it in the third act. And there's like, you can tell he had no restrictions whatsoever. And so I think if I had to pick a James Wan film for like anyone to watch, that might be my pick, would be Malignant.
How about you, JT? Your thoughts on James Wan?
Yeah, man. I think if you look at Saw, that is like the blueprint which Blumhouse wants to follow with every single film. Small budget, very small budget. Some, you know, actors who aren't quite A-listers, but a great concept that just hearing, like, if somebody just read the back of the Blu-ray, I'm like, okay, I want to watch that movie. And that's really what Saw is. And that was his big coming out party to, you know, the cinema world. Saw was a movie that was all about word of mouth. You heard about the movie. It had a crazy ending. You had to go see it in theaters. And I remember watching in theaters, and at times the acting was kind of bad. There were like actual people laughing in my theater when they weren't supposed to be laughing. But again, this was James Wan kind of just, you know, making a small budget, high concept film. And it just feels so perfect that he's with Blumhouse and making these other films, because I just feel like that Blumhouse built their whole model, what James Wan did with that first movie. And then The Conjuring, you know, being a huge hit and being one of the biggest, most successful franchises of anything that's running right now. And the funny thing is, we're here to talk about Insidious, the next film in that series. And I was always more of an Insidious guy. I thought the first Insidious film was better than the first Conjuring movie. I get The Conjuring is a little more bigger budget, and I like the setting of the 70s. But I don't know, man, that first Insidious movie just scared me more. It was more creepy. It stuck with me longer after leaving the theater. There were times when The Conjuring, by the end of the movie, when it becomes like an exorcism film, it felt, I was like, I've seen this before. There's nothing new here. Insidious felt so new and different, and it scares you with just shadows. You know, he doesn't just rely on jump scares, and that's something I really like about James Wan. He really builds a dreading feel over his films. And he does have a certain energy, like Khan says, which does transfer to action movies, apparently, because I thought Fast 7 is one of the better Fast Furious movies. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Aquaman. So that energy that he was able, you could see in his horror films, he just applied it differently to those big action summer blockbusters. And I think it worked really well. But his camera work is never lazy. And that's another thing about him. Even when he's making these small budget horror films, the things he does with the camera are inventive, and they're motivated by the scene. And I don't think James Wan gets enough credit for his visual style, because I do feel like he has a visual style. I'm like, oh, this is a James Wan movie. You can tell. And I do think the movies that have come after him, like The Conjuring, last Conjuring film was not directed by him. The last Insidious movie we're going to talk about was not directed by him, or the previous two, which were prequels, weren't directed by him. And I don't enjoy those movies for the most part as much as the ones that he's involved with. I do think he's a good director, and I think when he makes those movies, he does make them better. Malignant, I loved. I'm just going to say it right now. It is you know, it's like the movie you find in the back of Blockbuster back in the day that never made the theaters, and you're like, what's this, Basket Case? It's alive. I'm just gonna rent this weird ass horror movie. It felt like a throwback to, like, back in the day you would go to Walmart and it'd be like the, you know, $2-3 bin of movies, and there'd be some weird ass horror movie in there you'd never heard of, but you'd go and watch it and just have a blast with. And I feel like that's what he was recreating. It was a breath of fresh air after making Aquaman and Fast and Furious. It was nice to see him go back and go, hey, this is the genre I love. This is the genre I started with. And I think it was just a great fun time at the movies. So James Wan, he created this universe, but I think he still stands out amongst all the product.
Now, I'll agree with you. I just in the last like 48 hours have watched the first Insidious movie. So I obviously wanted to know a little bit of context before going into The Red Door, which is almost kind of a direct sequel to it. And yeah, what he does, and there are jump scares that come out, but the music that he has, like the music spikes, and then, you know, you see these just creepy imageries, especially like the red faced demon. Like James Wan just must like sit at home and read like The Darkhold, like constantly, to come up with these crazy ideas. Cause he has just this incredible like world that he's created, especially the first Insidious, especially with like the idea of the Further, right? Which is this almost like shadow dimension that exists. And there's people who are basically capable of projecting themselves into this world, the travelers, right? And that's kind of the whole storyline. And just to be able to think of something like that was before Stranger Things and the Upside Down, right? So you almost have to think like, oh, did that inspire like the Duffy brothers who created Stranger Things and the whole idea of like, they're just being like a counter earth kind of idea behind there. And I appreciate his action movies. Like, I know I joke a little bit about like how terrible Aquaman is, but the action sequences are on point. And Fast 7 is one of the better entries into the Fast and Furious franchise. So he is able to just kind of jump different genres. And I mentioned it when we were talking DC movies a few weeks ago, that like the scenes in the trench in Aquaman are extremely like horror related type like scenes. And I enjoy, that's my favorite segment of Aquaman, is anything that has to do with the trench and these weird creatures, and just his vision is incredible. So I'm excited actually to see more of James Wan outside of the horror element, and just give him these entries into these movies that already exist, because he adds kind of a fantastical like layer to them. But yeah, I appreciate James Wan, and having just recently watched the first Insidious and then its direct sequel, I very much appreciate the first Insidious a lot more than the Red Room, the Red Door, excuse me, which we'll talk about in the next segment. But yeah, I definitely think James Wan, and you guys have all touched on it, has that energy. His film has those energies to it. He's great with his like color palettes in his movies. Saw had that kind of like weird green tint to it throughout the entire movie, and Aquaman was just color explosion all over your face, and The Conjuring, like the shadows, but then he chooses to use like the red faced demon, so you don't see much of the demon because it's just a shadow, but the face is just so brilliant, and like, oh fuck, that movie's creepy. But yeah, I definitely appreciate James Wan. Now seen in the first Insidious movie, and now having seen its direct sequel, and I saw the original Saw movie, I've seen Aquaman, I saw Fast 7. So I can appreciate what James Wan is doing. The guy horrifies me. I feel like if I saw him like in an alley, he would steal my soul from me and then feed on it. But hey, the dude's got vision, and he's got a certain energy that you guys have touched on that he brings to these movies. So he's definitely talented man.
It's so funny to hear that, because I met James Wan once at Comic-Con. We were walking the floor. I was with Mark and Christian from Schmoes Know, and we ran into him, and he was like a short guy, but super nice, super chill. Like, I don't think you would be scared of a moose if you ran into him. He is such a nice, cool guy, but I understand where you're coming from.
Like, the thoughts that must run through that guy's head. Like, does he just have like a nightmare journal that he like wakes up in the middle of the night and scribbles down like
you know, tumors all over. You know? It's just creepy stuff, man. Betty, what's your take on James Wan? How many of his movies have you seen? Do you enjoy his movies?
I have seen quite a few of them. I really like James Wan as a director, man. But I know this as will have fallen out of favor nowadays, but in a lot of ways, he's like a George Lucas. He's a much better director than George Lucas, don't get me wrong. But he creates like worlds that then other directors and other creatives come in and play in and take it in their own direction. And I'm fascinated by people that have the minds like that. The hardest thing in the world is to create a universe out of nothing, to build an entire world. And a lot of guys, you know, that's their entire life. They build one world. Like George Lucas, you know, for other things he was involved in, his entire life was creating this one Star Wars world. Yeah. But James Wan is, even though they're all like horror related, he has now created like multiple worlds that other directors and creatives come in and play in. He's created Saw, which is at 8,000 movies right now. The Conjuring, which is like 5 or 6, Insidious, which is at 5. And so I think it's so impressive that he is doing that. And the ones that he helms, like sometimes I like the sequels better when other people come in, because I don't, you know, James Wan doesn't add a lot of humor in a lot of his movies. He goes for this really sort of intense vibe. And I like my horror with a little camp in it.
Well, he corrected you with Malignant. I think
Malignant is true. Malignant is true. Malignant is wonderful. Go out and watch it today if you are a horror fan and like just weirdness. It is excellent. But anyway, that's all I really have to say is he's a very solid director. I like a lot of the movies. You know, when Saw first came out, like I liked the first Saw, but I'm not a big fan of the other Saw movies in general. To me, it was kind of like a Sixth Sense kind of vibe. Like once you knew that twist in the first one, you know, when you go back, you already know the twist. It doesn't have the same impact. But then years later, like the Conjuring movies, like I absolutely adore the franchise. Like even the Curse of La Llorona and Annabelle Returns, the lesser entries, I still enjoy those movies like a lot. And even Insidious, all 5 of these movies are to me like okay to good. And I respect him because he's created like multiple cinematic universes now that I enjoy visiting. So I have nothing negative to say about him.
I will say, yeah, that is rare for Benny. I will say it's interesting how like a small segment in one of his movies, like The Conjuring, could become its own franchise. So Annabelle opened the first Conjuring movie. She now has like 3 sequels. The Nun was one of the scariest things of The Conjuring 2. And then it had its own spinoff movie. And then the trailer for The Nun 2 was playing in front of the Red Door this weekend. So that's a whole nother franchise that branched off. Now, I think I do agree, like, it's fun that other directors come in and get to put their stamp on it. But I hated the first Nun movie. I just hated it.
Enjoyed that, man.
You enjoyed it? I don't know. Maybe, listen, everyone pick your poison. But here's the thing. I think Annabelle Creation, which was the second Annabelle film, might be my favorite of all the Conjuring films. The Nun, the Annabelles, and the Conjurings. There's been 3 Conjurings. There's been how many Annabelles? I don't know. And then we got 2 Nuns coming out. I think Annabelle Creation, who was directed by the guy who did Shazam, David F. Sandberg. Yeah, he directed Creation. And that might be my favorite, scariest film out of the whole franchise for me. I think I might be a little bit of a loner in that one. I know a lot of people love the first Conjuring and some of the other films. But for me, like Annabelle Creation is an example of a director who's now making big budget films, even though his last one was a flop. But there's a director like who has a career now because of that first film that he did in the Conjuring universe. And my favorite of the Annabelle films, I thought Annabelle Comes Home was okay. It was kind of interesting to have all in one house and all these things come alive. Felt a little bit like Night Museum, but in a horror museum. I thought the first Annabelle was pretty weak. But you're getting different directors every time. So you're just getting like, the batting average is all over the place, but at the end of the day, James Wan is producing all these things, and I think he has made a very successful horror universe, which all the studios want right now, any kind of universe. If you give me a universe, I'm happy, and he's given them a really profitable one.
And Jeffrey, I'm going to toss this to you, because you see that like Wan has created these initial universes and then kind of turned them over to other directors. Does that hurt these entries into these franchises, in your opinion? Or, to JTE's point, like, does it help new directors put a different view on this universe? Does it help the entries? What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I guess there's good and bad to it. If James Wan directs literally every Conjuring movie, it might start to feel stale after like the fifth or sixth one, even if it is like a more superior director at the helm. But I think passing it off allows for different visions, even if they're not, even if the quality isn't the same for all of them. I think it's probably better to have the variety of people trying their take on it than James Wan doing literally everything. So,
well, the good news, at least for one guy, Patrick Wilson, is that James Wan keeps him employed. Certainly doesn't seem like very many other studios are, but James Wan is definitely giving Patrick Wilson a paycheck. I feel like there should be like an exchange, like he gets like a 25% cut of whatever Patrick Wilson's royalties are.
You're my guy.
Part of me feels like people went and saw this movie, like I said earlier, they just saw Patrick Wilson and they were like, oh, it's a Conjuring movie. He's so tied to that franchise now. And it's like, oh, okay, it's a Conjuring movie. It has nothing to do with the Conjuring universe. Insidious is its own thing. And I will say this, you know, the Insidious franchise is up and down for me overall. But I love that they kind of put in time travel into these movies, especially in the second one, and even when the one we're about to talk about, it's kind of felt, I had that Back to the Future 2 feeling where Marty goes back to the first movie, and they do that a lot in these Conjuring films. And I think that's an interesting aspect to bring into a horror franchise, that I can't, a time travel horror movie hasn't been done yet. There's a film called Time Crimes, but those are more thrillers than they are horror films. And I thought that gave Insidious a really cool angle that nobody else was really trying.
One thing we were talking about, like in our opening segment, about like the lack of just movie stars drawing people in, but like Patrick Wilson, he has become a genre star just in horror in general. So like, I think even if it was like outside of this, if you put Patrick Wilson in a horror movie at this point, it's going to have a certain draw. So, I mean, it's a redefining of a movie star. Like, I don't think he could open like a giant action movie or things like that, but I think Patrick Wilson will give any horror movie at this point a solid opening. And so I think he's, when we're looking at movie stars, I think he's kind of the new definition where he's attached himself to a genre and he has a reliable fan base in that genre.
It's a good point, Benny. Well done. Well, final thoughts, gentlemen. Anybody have anything else to add about James Wan before we decide to go into our spoiler review of Joyride and Insidious, The Red Door?
Hopefully Aquaman 2 isn't terrible.
Yeah, I like that he's jumping genres and, you know, franchises. I do think he brought a spark of energy to Fast 7. And I think Aquaman felt like a kid playing with his toys, but with a $300 million budget. So I enjoy seeing that. He reminds me a little bit of Steven Sommers, who directed The Mummy, G.I. Joe, Van Helsing. He has a little bit of that in him. It's a little chaotic, but I kind of like that chaotic vibe. I love there's going to be an explosion out of nowhere every 30 seconds. I don't see it coming. And it wakes me up in my theater like, oh, my God. So I like seeing him doing these action films, but I am glad that he goes back to the genre that he loves. That's why Malignant was such a fun time, because he was like, I'm just going to go back and make a really low-budget, fun horror movie. And I hope he does that. I hope he does that more often. I hope every once in a while he'll just dip back into a low budget horror film, because you could tell it is a genre that he loves making, and it's apparent every time he makes one. Like, oh, this guy loves horror movies, and I just feel like when you love what you're doing and you love what you're making, it kind of bleeds into the film. You could feel it, and that's what I love about him. So I'm a big James Wan fan. I can't wait to see what, you know, give him a Transformers movie. Let him do Rise of the Beast Part 2 or something. I think he would actually do a really good job with something like that.
Interesting.
His films make money. So, yeah.
Oh, for sure. I'm with JT. I think Fast 7 is probably his most impressive, like, film, at least for me, aside from Insidious and these lower budget horror movies, which, again, like this recent one, we talked about it in the last segment. They gave Patrick Wilson a $16 million budget. You know, James Wan was probably on set with that guy nonstop. And in that $16 million, it's already doubled. That movie is going to make 100% profit margin for Blumhouse Films. But Fast 7 was, I think, the hardest Fast and the Furious entry to probably film. You had to ease out the passing of Paul Walker and his character. in that series. And the fact that he came in and was able to accomplish like a sweet send off to Paul Walker in that movie. And then he has not revisited it again, but of the Fast and the Furious franchise, that's probably the most tentpole like in the series, because you had to halfway through filming deal with the passing of what is essentially, you know, Brian Walker's character in the Fast and the Furious, especially for the first seven movies. He's the guy. It's Dom Toretto and it's Brian Walker. So the accomplishment and the send off that he had to Paul Walker and kind of providing that legacy to him. Now, have the Fast and Furious movies improved afterwards? Fuck no, they haven't. But that entry is definitely, I think, probably the best one in the series. Well, folks, we are going to take a commercial break. And up next, we're going to start with Joyride segment with our good buddy, Jeffrey Kahn. And then we'll go into Insidious, The Red Door. Stay tuned.
They came to Earth for help.
You are our last hope.
Maybe I should get some pants on.
We are actors, not astronauts.
This Christmas, blast off.
The whole thing was just a misunderstanding.
Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver.
You could put an eye out with that.
They are so cute.
Galaxy Quest.
What is it? I don't know. Let's hit it with a rock.
Rated PG. Start Saturday, December 25th everywhere.
Bill's afraid to eat his stuffed crust backwards.
I'm not afraid.
Shh, shh, shh. Don't speak.
Don't be afraid. Stuffed crust pizza has a ring of cheese baked right into the crust, and a large one topping is $9.99.
Keep your chin up, Bill.
Stuffed crust, another one of the best pizzas under one roof.
Welcome back, folks. And we are going to kick off our review segment. We're going to be reviewing two movies today. First, we're going to be reviewing Joyride, which we asked our good friend Jeffrey Kahn to come on and discuss. Now, JT and Benny, in full disclosure, have not seen this movie yet. I have, and we asked our good buddy Jeffrey to come on and also give us his take on that. So, Jeff, you're our guest. Thank you again for coming on, my friend. Mm-hmm. Joyride, what did you think of this movie?
I don't usually like to compare movies, but this is 100% better than No Hard Feelings, which I saw like a week ago. This is like, it promised raunchiness and it delivers. Unlike No Hard Feelings, but I feel like outside of the naked fight scene from Jennifer Lawrence, doesn't really have a lot of raunchy humor. The four leads of this movie are all great. You can tell they have really good chemistry together. And it goes for it, in certain places, both comedically and dramatically. At the end, I started getting a little choked up at the emotion they were able to wring out of me. But yeah, it's a fun time. It's a short movie. It's only 90 minutes. And you're definitely going to laugh a lot, even if it's not like culturally specific to you. So I had fun.
I will agree with that, because it is not culturally specific to me. Right. I'm not Asian American. However, the humor in this movie absolutely hits. And I know this, the part that you're talking about, and I 100% agree. I got a little choked up too, especially when she meets her, spoiler, dead mother's husband, and he shows her the video. Mm. Yeah, that had me. And
of course, Daniel Day-Kim, because that's, you can't go wrong with Daniel Day-Kim.
You cannot go wrong with Daniel Day-Kim. But I agree 100% too. The chemistry between the four main leads is awesome. And I'm just going to say, Stephanie Hsu is, mm-hmm. Yeah, she is incredible. We can sit here and discuss if she was robbed for not getting the Oscar versus Jamie Lee Curtis, but fine. She has said that she is joyfully at peace with it. And I will be too, because I just want as much of her in movies moving forward as we can possibly get.
Sure.
The tattoo scene with her in this movie, oh, they really went for it. And man, I couldn't stop. Like, I have not laughed that hard in a movie in a very, very long time. Most of the time, like, and I'm kind of a hard crowd to please when it comes to like laughing out loud in theaters. But in this case, man, I couldn't stop freaking laughing at this movie. It was extremely raunchy. And Jeffrey, you mentioned it too. Like, there, aside from a couple of scenes and No Hard Feelings, like No Hard Feelings, we talked about it a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
it definitely was just, it was fine. They either needed to pick a lane and go full raunch, or, you know, coming of age type movie, you know, Jennifer Lawrence growing from the experience. And this movie, they I think it balanced it so much better. You had the, like, the moments where they were growing, you had the heartfelt moments, but also you just had this like balls to wall raunch. And it was so much fun. And I really do hope that this movie develops legs and more people go and see it, because it didn't do very well. It did 6 million so far this weekend. And I don't know if they were thinking like a Crazy Rich Asian type turnout, but if you remember, Crazy Rich Asians didn't debut at the top. It had legs. Good word of mouth like helped that movie become a success. And I really do hope that good word of mouth will help this movie out, because this, more people need to see this. This movie is awesome.
I've seen the comparison more aptly is to Bridesmaids or Girls Trip. This is like the Asian version of those movies. And so it's like, you don't have to go into it, you know, just as like, oh, if I'm not Asian, I'm not going to enjoy this. You can go in, expect like Bridesmaids level humor. And I think you'll be happy that you went to go see it. So
could you give me a different comparison to make it?
Yeah.
Do you like The Hangover? It also has like, it reminds you of The Hangover.
Does it have that kind of like, you know, really fast paced humor that you will see in like The Hangover and things like that?
Yeah, sometimes the jokes are just flying by like a mile a minute, but sometimes it'll slow down and then insert a really funny joke and then go back to serious stuff. So yeah, I think it has good variety.
And if I go out and see this week, if I go out and do a second night at the movies this week, because you know I have a family and things like that, and I only get one movie night, I make another one for this movie coming. Am I going to regret it?
I would say no. I think the tattoo scene that Moose is referencing, it doubles down on that joke so hard that like you've never seen that in a movie before, and I just like, not only for the shock value but for the comedic value, I think it's, that alone might be worth going to see Joyride.
Yes, I agree 100%. You will not be disappointed, Benny. I actually think a lot of this humor will hit well for you. I know you're not a big Bridesmaids fan, but I do think that this movie is a better version of that movie. Like Khan said, this is kind of a female Hangover, Bridesmaids, Girls Trip type movie. I would actually kind of give it a little more like to a Girls Trip, just because of like some of the stuff is so freaking zany and like raunchy, but man, it's a ton of fun. I would highly recommend you go see this, Benny.
Also, if you're a fan of like the NBA from like the 2000s, Baron Davis is in this movie. So, and he gets a little more to do than just like a cameo and saying, oh, there's Baron Davis. He actually gets a little bit to do. So that was fun as well.
The basketball like segment was so freaking funny, especially like what happens the next day.
I was thinking about like No Hard Feelings doesn't have like an actual sex scene. This actually does. Like this, you know, it promises sex and raunchiness and drugs and all of that, and it actually delivers all of those things. So yeah,
absolutely, it does. Yeah, when she first meets the potential like client and then vomits all over. it's fantastic, guys. I would highly recommend it. Well, Jeffrey, we appreciate you coming on, man. You're welcome to stick around for the Insidious segment. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Yeah, I'll hang out, but yeah, I have not.
Fair enough. But I think on the whole, this movie is great. It has the right feels. It has the raunchy comedy. It is definitely an R-rated comedy, but I really do hope that that Joyride, not to be confused with the Paul Walker,
Steve Zahn.
Yeah. Joyride. But I do hope this one starts to establish and grow legs. Well, on to our next review. And I'm going to lead off with JT, because JT and Benny, you guys have seen all of the Insidious movies at this point. I have seen the first one and I have seen this one. So we're going to be reviewing Patrick Wilson's directorial debut of Insidious, The Red Door. JT, your initial thoughts?
Yeah, first let me say this. I love the first Insidious movie. Like I said, I prefer it over The Conjuring. So I didn't revisit that one because it's just in my head so well that I didn't need to revisit it. But I did revisit the second film, which I'm very glad I did, because The Red Door literally at times takes you into part two. So I'm really glad I revisited the second film. I will say, revisiting the second film, which was directed by James Wan, I didn't really enjoy it that much. I thought it's an okay sequel. To me, it was interesting and had really interesting ideas, which the time travels really comes into play in that second film. So I respect some of the things that James Wan did with it, but it did feel overly long to me. And I was like, I had trouble keeping my interest while I was watching part two. Unfortunately, I got to take those same feelings and put them into this third film. Because while I saw what he was doing, and it did feel familiar to the first two films, more so the second film, I don't know. I felt more jump scare to me than it did creepiness. And I think what the first Insidious film does so well is putting this feeling of dread and like this sinister feeling throughout the film. Like everything just feels uneasy. And I think Patrick Wilson, who directed this third film, was trying to do that, but it just didn't work for me. I could see the setup for every jump scare coming kind of a mile away. And I love Patrick Wilson as an actor. I don't think he's a bad director, but this is what happens when you get somebody like Patrick Wilson, who's directing for the first time. Sure, he's been in a lot of horror movies, but then compared to somebody like James Wan, who probably has seen every horror movie that's ever been made and just knows how to build up to a jump scare, how to build up to that creepiness. It just really kind of showed you how different class a filmmaker James Wan is compared to Patrick Wilson. Now, I didn't like dislike this movie. I wasn't like, oh my God, get me out of here. But when you watch a movie and you feel like you know what's going to happen before it happens, even when it comes to the jump scares, it does kind of undercut the film in a lot of ways. I do think it's cool that you got Rose Byrne back, even though she's a supporting character. And I do like the fact that this does feel like a sequel to those first two films. It just never really scared me. And at the end of the day, I need to be scared a little bit. I think, again, there are some cool concepts, cool ideas that were in this film that were borrowed from the last films. But I never felt that sense of dread and horror and terror and uneasiness that I felt like the other Insidious films always gave me. So it's a miss for me. Overall, it's a miss, but it's he tried, he did his best, and it's not a horrible film. And I'm actually glad it's making money because I want Patrick Wilson. He seems like such a good guy. I want him to have success, and I want him to make other films, maybe something outside of the horror genre. But overall, this movie to me, it's just a basic okay to a miss. Like, I would only recommend you see this if you're a big fan of the Insidious franchise. If you're just a casual fan, I think this is something you could wait till streaming or something else down the line. It's not something you can run the theater to see. So that's my overall thoughts.
How about you, Benny? What's your overall thoughts on Insidious: The Red Door?
So I'm going to talk about this movie, and it's going to sound like I'm talking about it in like a negative light. And I wanted to make it clear, I like this movie. It's a decent movie. I think it's worth a matinee ticket to the theater. But it is like going and watching a cover band, a good cover band. So you can tell that Patrick Wilson, that is his first movie, and you can tell that he has spent a lot of time working with James Wan. The movie is full of like James Wan's style and James Wan's tropes, but they're not quite done as well as James Wan, and they don't always land timing wise. So, and JTE is perfectly right. Like the jump scares in the movie, they don't work because they're too obvious, and he relies very heavily on like these fake out jump scares during the movie that don't really work because the jump scares didn't work. Now the time travel and things like that in the movie that I enjoyed, and other than I don't understand one aspect of the ending, I like how they added more in to the further how it interacts with living people. I think they added more elements into it to make, the further and everything a more interesting concept going forward into another movie. It in itself is a fairly generic modern horror movie, but if you like those, you'll have a good time with it. Like my personal feelings is one and this one are the least interesting to me personally in the entire series. And it's just like my horror movies, what I love, like I said, like my favorite horror movie of all time is Army of Darkness, which is essentially a comedy with a lot of horror elements. And so I like that campiness. I like the bad Friday the 13th movies where they got ridiculous. And so to me, the nerds that come in the house and make the odd comments, they were sorely missing in this movie. It missed levity. It was too emo. And so I wish that they had brought back those people that brought that levity to the other movies. And one thing that stopped this from being a really good movie, like, I think the second Conjuring movie is an excellent, excellent horror movie. I know JTE's not a fan, but one thing it did really great is it explains to you why this villain has chosen this family, how it got a connection to this family, and why we need to be scared of it. Both in the first Conjuring, both in the first Insidious and in the Red Door, they show you like this scary looking red faced creature, but they never flesh out who the scary red faced creature is or why he gives a shit about this family and has chosen them, other than that they happen to be there. Whereas in all of the other installments of the Insidious franchise, there's at least some connection of how this creature got involved in this family or this person's life, and this is why they are terrifying. And I thought that was missing. Like I said, if you like the modern sort of James Wan horror movie, you will like this. Just know it's not as good as his version. And those are my overall thoughts. It's solid, but you can tell it's a copy.
So having just recently seen the first Insidious, not seeing any additional installments, and then seeing this one, the time travel thing, because I understand it, it comes to play in the second movie. So that one did take me out a little bit because I didn't quite grasp. I understood what was happening in the context of the film, but it was just like, oh, now you can time travel in the further. But I like you guys too. Also, like, the first jump scare got me, but then the fake outs, I started at that point in time, like the first jump scare got me because I'm a sissy. And then I was like, okay, it's coming. Oh, there's the setup for it. Like, I also found it very paint by numbers when it came to like the jump scares and the horror element to it. I agree. I like a little bit of explanation. I would have liked to have known the connection to some of these otherworld entities that were plaguing this family, especially and I don't know, maybe it's explained in the other ones, but like the old woman who kind of plagues Patrick Wilson's character, Josh.
Like, she's the primary villain in part two, and they explain why she specifically is chosen him.
Okay, then I will give part two a watch then, because that always, I just, after having seen this one and the first Insidious, and I agree with you guys both that the first Insidious is a much better movie. It's very little is actually shown, but it's referenced. Like the red, especially with the red faced demon, like you just see shadows or you'll see like the quick outline of like the face. What I liked about the first one versus like just showing too much, what James Wan was able to do with the first one is like, there's a drawing that like the lady is like silently described the, what is her name? Lin Shaye. She plays the like psychic in the first one. And Lin Shaye is like the creepy old woman in every single like horror franchise, and she plays that to perfection. In the first one, she's like describing it to, you know, there's the two guys, the Specs and Tuckers, and it was good to see those guys back again in this installment. But the way that they like set up the demon and the way that they set up these like other world entities and the further and the explanation behind it is so well done. And in this one, it just isn't as crisp as it was in the first. So while I'm not walking away from this movie saying I absolutely hated it, just know, folks, that I'm not a horror fan. But there are certain horror movies, and there's certain movies like the first Insidious, which are, in my opinion, just great movies. And while the first Insidious movie scared the living crap out of me, I also walked away from it and was like, that was a really, really well done movie. This was not that. This movie was fine. This was a jump scare movie. This was those horror movies that come in and make, you know, double or triple their budget because people like to go get scared in movie theaters. And then they just fade away, you know, in the talk of like all time great horror movies. I think personally, the first Insidious movie can maybe be in one of those like top 10 greatest horror movies. into that conversation. This one definitely is not going to be anywhere close to that conversation. This won't even break like the top 100. It's fine. It's a serviceable movie. It maybe puts a pin in the story of like the of Patrick Wilson's character with Rose Byrne and their son. Like, that's it. If they're going to do more Insidious stories with it, you know, the further as kind of a central point, like, you need to really kind of introduce new people. Like, I understand, like, the post-credit scene, and here's a quick little spoiler, like, they shut the red door, which means realistically, like, they're shut off now from the further. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the further is shut off for everyone in the world. There has to be other travelers in the world, right? In the first one, the Elise character kind of brings that up, that that there are people in this world who can travel into the further. So while I think this will probably be the last Insidious movie to feature like Patrick Wilson and his family, I'm not shut off from the idea that more stories can be told about the further. And this movie is a fine enough send off for this family, as far as I'm concerned. Benny, you're muted.
So if you watch part two and three and four of the franchise, that is a different family. So those are prequels involving like other families, and they're more focused on Specs and Tucker and the older lady dealing with problems. They're sort of like Ghostbusters,
okay,
a horror version of Ghostbusters, which I think is part of the reason that I really enjoyed those, you know. But one thing I wanted to say that this movie does really well, because, you know, I did like the movie, and so I didn't want it to end on an all negative, is that the first movie gets, I think, a lot of its power and a lot of the ambiance that it creates that people react to is just how terrifying it would be if your kid gets really sick, you know, and you don't understand why, or if your family member starts experiencing all of these terrifying psychological issues and you don't understand why. I think that's why the jump scares in that first movie work so well, is because they create like a really strong backdrop that people can understand, you know, in from the real world perspective. And this movie, they touched on it a little bit, which I thought was really interesting, that this family has grown up and their dad at one point tries to kill them, you know, and one of them was in a coma. They've been through a lot of traumatic stuff. And there are points in this movie where they start to touch on it, where I think you have like a really interesting psychological horror movie. I don't think they follow through and get to it, but I think there are some really interesting like things that you could flesh out. So I think there are a lot of really interesting ideals of, you know, what the family went through. They touched on, they didn't quite nail them, but I would say, to me, if you're invested in the story of this family, there are enough interesting elements in this movie to make it worth going out and see.
Well, we are going to discuss some spoilers on this next segment. And I'll kick us off with the first spoiler. So folks, if you have not seen Insidious and you aren't interested in seeing Insidious and don't want to be spoiled, pause us, go watch the movie, and then come back and let us three give you our takes on these spoilers. But I'm going to kick this off with, I think, what was my most interesting spoiler from the movie. And that's the relationship that Patrick Wilson starts to understand about his father. And you learn in the first movie that Patrick Wilson's character has the ability to be able to astral project, and he passed that on to his son. And you learn about Patrick Wilson's father in this one and how his father also had the ability to astral project, but assumed that it was mental illness and then ended up killing himself. And now he resides in the further because he's a tortured spirit. He obviously didn't pass from one realm to the another peacefully, right? And he now exists in this world, and you think at first he's kind of tormenting, but then he almost helps him out in the movie. While that's extremely predictable that the father is going to help out the son, it worked for me. That was what I found was one of the more interesting, because like you, Benny, I like a little bit of explanation in some of these horror movies. The first one did it well when they were explaining the whole astral projection and the further. And so finding out that, you know, Josh's father, and I can't remember the character's name, it was like Foster or something. But finding out that like his father struggled with this also and possessed it and obviously passed it along again, to his son. I mean, you can kind of see like, okay, if they were at any point going to continue with like the Lambert story, is it then Dalton who passes it on to his son in a few years, right? So you can kind of continue that lineage if you wanted to, or that storyline, but the whole father son and the father struggling with the ability to enter into the further, I did find interesting. I don't know your guys' thoughts. What's some of your what worked, what didn't work? Give us the spoilers.
I think the tonal shift at times felt a little off. Like some characters felt like they were in another movie. And that to me mainly goes to the actress who played Dalton's new friend at the college. She was just so upbeat and kind of loose and like funny all the time. Where I'm like, there's demons coming through the walls. Things are happening. And she seems to be taking it so like jokey and kind of like not too serious that it took me out of the movie a little bit. I was just like, I really liked her at first. I was like, oh, this is a fun character. Someone who's, you know, very outgoing and the opposite of what Dalton is. Yet her character never seemed to change when the situation would change. She was just always like, all right, let's get these lights on. All right, Dalton, you know, try not to go too crazy over there. And I'm like, this woman seems to be taking it really well that a supernatural event is happening with her, with this guy. So I felt like her character, while at first I thought would be a fun addition, never really molded herself to the story or the vibe of the rest of the movie and the tone that was going on. So, you know, unfortunately I'll have to put that on Patrick Wilson. You know, he was the director. I don't know what he was just like, yo, this is our, you know, release valve for the audience. Like she's the one person we go to where you can kind of relax and have a good time. But I just felt like she kind of stepped on the toes of the horror aspect of the movie in a lot of ways. So to me, the tone at times was kind of off. And then the bully who went to the college looked like, you know, the guy from Parks and Rec, John Mafio, where he had like that hair going on. And like, he was kind of off to me. Like I almost wanted to be a little more douchebaggy and less, I don't know. So to me, there were some tones and characters that just felt out of place and didn't quite do what I needed them to do from what I like in a horror movie. So that's how I kind of felt with the tone and the characters. I felt a little bit all over the place. And I wish they would have used Rose Byrne a little bit more. She comes to play a little bit more towards the end of the film, but she's such a big aspect of those first two films. I got to think maybe scheduling. She maybe had other things going on and she was only able to do maybe a couple days of shooting. So that's my explanation for that. But I wish she had a little bit more of a bigger part. I thought the guy who plays Dalton, the same kid from the original film, one that made me feel old. I feel like I saw Insidious just like not that long ago. And he's a grown man. I thought he did a good job. I thought Patrick Wilson did a good job. And I think there are some interesting stories, especially with the father and son aspect going on several levels in this film. It just didn't all come together for me in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And it's disappointing. Well, I see the skeleton work for like maybe a really good Insidious movie. It just didn't all come together, which honestly, when you make a movie, you never know what's going to come together, what's not going to come together.
Sure.
I think they tried their best and they made an acceptable conclusion for this movie franchise, but nothing comes close to the first one. I do want to say, to Benny's point, he likes that the ghosts have like a reason for being there. When I get that, and I think the sequels do a good job of that, but I also love the concept of the door was open because he was able to go to the other side and something evil came through and we don't know what. To me, that's a little bit more scary to me. The unknown, like, oh, it's all good. You know, you're just communicating with dead. It's like, uh-oh, something came through and it's evil, pure evil. Like, to me, that's like a little more scary than knowing what the ghost's backstory is. But that's just taste.
So I'll argue with you on that point, and I would say that this movie was missing an explanation of the villain. And if you watch part four of the franchise, you know, which I enjoy quite a bit. So at that point, the how they defeat this villain is they release these corpses and a living woman that are being captured. That's how they defeat it. And you know it because that entity holds people captive. That's what it does. And it got involved with them because it's connected to a prison. So it's all very linear. This is how we defeat the villain because this is what its motivation is. And this is how we beat it. In this movie, since you don't really know why this thing is here or anything about the thing other than that it is a thing, You know, the ending just seems like random. He's just like, I'm going to just paint this picture black.
You but know? He and, is the villain from the first film. So, like, you have a history with this villain.
Yeah, but even
this demon.
But even in the first film, they never flesh out. And that's why I said to me, part one and this one are the weakest entries in the thing, because this villain has never been explained at any point. So I get that he followed them, but randomly painting a picture black is not dramatic. It is not an epic standoff. And I don't know why that would defeat this thing. Like, if I were to go in and pick a fight with a demon, I would at least like to know how to kill it, you know? And if it turns out that making a peanut butter sandwich kills it, it would be good to know why that is going to kill it. It is helpful for me as an audience member.
I agree with you, but you're referring to the third film. So I agree with you very much in that, like, the whole painting of the door. I was like, where's this coming from? What's happening here?
Yeah. The first
film though, like, he kidnapped that kid in the other world. And when Patrick Wilson had to go save his son just from this demon, and he had this creepy record player, like, in the window, like, that just creeped the hell out of me, because I don't know what that is except for something that's pure evil. And so to me, like, the first film is more of a rescue. You know, he goes in there to rescue his son to get away from this thing, because when you leave the door open, you never know what might step through that door. And this one, I agree. He's the same thing. It's just an evil, evil spirit. But the third film doesn't really give you set up rules or set up ways to deal with it. It just kind of comes up with it. It kind of feels like they're just coming up with it as they go along. And I think that makes it a little bit weak in a film.
Well, if we're talking about the third one, okay, it has the creepiest moment out of the entire series. And that's where the girl is walking on the broken legs. Like, that in this entire series of films is the only moment where I jumped back and I was like, whoa, that freaked me out. And that, I'm not, you know, ambiance in horror movies doesn't really get to me, you know? So that one moment stuck out to me more than any other moment in the entire series.
It's so funny how different, because, like, to me, the first Insidious, there's a scene where Rose Byrne goes to check on her baby, and there just seems to be like an outline of a body behind the curtain, almost like a shadow. And that, to me, was like the scariest moment of all the Insidious films. Something that you can't quite make out what it is, but you could just make out a figure behind the curtain. So that, to me, was like one of the scariest moments of all the Insidious films for me. And it's just like, oh my God, like, what the hell? Like, that's creepy. So it's just funny how you and I have different. I see the broken legs. I'm like, oh, they hired a contortionist to be in this movie and put some makeup on them. Like, it didn't quite work the same for me.
Well, I have inverse taste in movies, and that's been well established. And, you know, I don't fight it anymore. Like, I like bad movies. I'm at peace with it. So whenever you guys are taking my recommendations, know that I will always choose Police Academy 5 over Citizen Kane. I have terrible taste. Accept it and deal.
I will say this. If there is a moment in this franchise that makes Benny have that type of a guttural reaction, I don't know if I'm going to tune into number three, because I don't know if mentally I can be able to handle that with my fragile horror state. Now, what do you guys think about the ending? I mean, we're touching on it. We're touching on, it wasn't very strong with the how to be able to kind of defeat and close this door, at least in my opinion. And then on the way out, we get, you know, the cameo of Lynn Shay showing up as Elise Rayner. Almost, you know, now that she exists in the further, and, you know, she almost has that moment where she makes amends with Josh, because spoilers for the first one, if you haven't seen it, 13 years ago, he kills her at the end of that movie. So I don't know. That was a neat little cameo, and maybe hearing that she's in these other movies, maybe that's just a way to shoehorn her in one final time. But it worked for me a little bit. It would make sense. She didn't leave this world peacefully, right? He brutally murders her in the first movie. So I don't, it worked for me. Your guys' thoughts on the ending?
Yeah, she's kind of the face of the franchise after Patrick Wilson, honestly. Okay. She went on into sequels and appeared more times. So I do think it was fun having her have that little cameo, because I do think if you're a fan of this franchise, she's a very important aspect to it. But, to you know, did it move me or anything? Not really. It's just like, yep, yeah, they're wrapping this up. Close all the doors, close all the windows. The story's wrapped up. And I am more excited to see where they go with another Insidious. Like you said, somebody else in the world has to be able to do these things. And I do think there's a world for more Insidious films with a new talented up-and-coming director in horror to put his own stamp on it. And I'd be curious to see those.
I would say, to me, like my own personal ending, I don't know if anyone else does this, but sometimes, like, as I watch a movie, like, I rewrite and remake the movie in my head as I'm watching it. And in the end, you know, I've watched my own movie regardless of what happens with the movie that I'm watching. And so the most impactful part of this movie for me is when he's doing the painting and it turns out he's actually painting his dad as the villain from these childhood memories. That is, at that point, they had me. I thought they had a real great ending set up. But then the mystical, I can paint demons away with a piece of chalk, I don't understand that. It still doesn't make sense. And I'll leave it at that. The ending doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the same boat. The ending was fine. And JT, I think you said it perfectly. Like, that's the pin. You know that this family story, these character stories, will not be returning again in the Insidious. They've closed that door. The little post-credit, like, light flicker just kind of indicates that, like, we're not done with the further. There'll be more, you know, that could potentially happen in this world, but it's certainly not going to involve the Lambert family or Spex and Tucker, Elise, Rayner, all those characters. But overall, the movie's fine. It's not the worst outing for a actor going into a director's chair. I mean, there's certainly been worse movies that have been directed by actors coming out. But JT, you said it yourself, like, Patrick Wilson is kind of the face of horror right now. And it only makes sense that this would be the next progression for him as an actor moving into the director seat. He's going to direct a franchise that probably put him on the mark. So it's fine, but we are going to wrap up, folks. And we do want to make sure that we thank our guest, Jeffrey the King Khan, for being on. It's always fun when we get our buddies from the Finstock Exchange back on and saying again. But Jeff, thanks for coming back on. Mm-hmm. Floor is yours, man. If you have anything to pitch or promote, please take it away.
Well, I like to ask, let me ask kind of a question. You're okay. Not a big horror guy. Well, what is, like, one of your favorite horror films? Just so we have an idea where your taste lies.
Yeah, I feel like I only recently started even watching horror movies, but I think okay. if talking about best horror movie, it's probably Get Out for me. Like,
wow, Blumhouse, yeah. Staying in a Blumhouse family. Yeah, that is one of the more recent, like, probably great horror films, satires. Mm. Interesting, okay.
But I also like another one that's Ready or Not. That's also mine.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
I loved Ready or Not.
Yeah.
That is an amazing movie. Go watch that instead.
Yeah. Yeah, go watch Ready or Not instead of Insidious, the Red Door.
All right, Con, plug away.
But yeah, just I guess my only plug would be just go watch Joyride, because it sounds like that might have been better than watching Insidious.
Yes.
But yeah, you can find me on Twitter at the King Con. You can find me on Letterboxd if you care about what I have to say about movies. And yeah, just thank you for letting me come on and talk about the Asian movie. Not that was stereotypical. It's just I wanted to talk about it.
you had reached out and been like, "Hey, did you watch this movie?" And I was like, "Yes, I got to have you on." Because Khan was the one who we had told me, he's like, "Dude, you really should see this movie." He said this, and I already wanted to see it. I like female led comedies, so good recommendation, Jeff. And thank you again for being on the show, buddy. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, we are going to wrap up. As always, thank you for tuning in. Please leave us a review. We'll definitely shout you out for your reviews of our channel. And thank you so much for tuning in. Next week, the big week, Mission Impossible. These movies only get better with every single entry. And they only get longer and more insane. And I'm sure we're going to have a lot of Tom Cruise running through our minds going up into our next show. So please tune in. We love y'all. Have a good rest of your day.